Well, this week, I reckon we've got probably the most diverse audience we've seen so far in the book of Mark. If you go through the list, we've got the chief priests, and we've got the elders, we've got the scribes, we've got the whole council, we've got Pilate, we've got the murderer Barabbas, and we have the crowd. You could say, if you like, we've got the whole world here this morning. And I say that because whenever Mark widens out a scene like this, he widens out the wide-angle lens, if you like, he tends to present us with a mini-picture of the world, if you like. Or if you want a flash word for that, a microcosm of society. I think it's a flash word, but I'll stick with a mini-picture of the world. And it's a purposeful thing that Mark's doing here, because there's a little bit of a Where's Waldo thing going on here. And that if you look hard enough, and if I do my job well enough, if you look hard enough at the scene here today, you should see yourself in here somewhere. That's what's going on here in Mark. And I think Mark does that to give us space for reflection, if you like, on the journey so far as we've gone through this gospel account. And it's space to really think, where are we at with the person of Jesus, based on what we've heard so far in this gospel? Or to quote Jesus' own words from Mark chapter 8, what about you? Who do you say that I am? So here is space, really, in this text today to consider our own response to that question. And to help us consider our response to that question, Mark, in our text today, he repeatedly puts before us the concept of authority. And that's a concept which has appeared throughout the Bible, really. And indeed, really, it's always been at the heart of man's tussle with God, hasn't it? Really, since the days of Adam and Eve. Authority has always been at the heart of the battle. And Mark does so in this text by the frequent use of a title, and it's a title used in mockery, but it's also a title which is ironically true. And that title is the King of the Jews. And in conjunction with this title and this concept of authority, there is a specific question that I think comes out of our text today. And that question to each and every one of us is, how are we responding to the authority of Jesus? Because you see, what we have here is a question of obedience to this authority. That is at the heart of our passage today. Because you see, you get this far into the Gospel of Mark, we're almost at the end, and you've seen this power and authority of Jesus so clearly on display so many times. And we've seen that he has the power and authority of God. Case in point, just to recap on a few of these moments, Mark 1:27, Jesus taught as one with the authority of God. And as he taught, the people were so amazed, and they asked each other, what is this? A new teaching and with authority. Or Mark 4, Jesus acted with the authority of God over creation. You might recall the storm on the Lake of Galilee, where Jesus is in there with the disciples, and they wake him up, and they say, teacher, don't you care if we drown? And he gets up, and he rebukes the wind, and says to the waves, quiet, be still, and it's flat as a mill pond. And they're terrified, and they ask each other, who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him. Or Mark 5, where Jesus has acted as one with the authority of God over death. As he raises this little girl, Jairus, the synagogue ruler's daughter, he raises her from the dead with the words, little girl, I say to you, get up. And she gets up, and they're completely astonished. But probably most significantly is in Mark chapter 2, where he acts as one with the power and authority of God over sin. And he says to the paralytic, as this paralytic is lowered through the ceiling, he says, son, your sins are forgiven. Now that, of course, is red rag to a bull for the teachers of the law, as they say, surely this man is blaspheming. Who can forgive sins but God alone? And in one sense, they are completely right, that only God can forgive sins, but this is God. And so as we've progressed through the gospel, we've seen that Jesus has the power and authority of God. And all of this, as we've gone through the gospel, all of this ought to be gathering momentum in our own hearts in our own convictions. But you see, it shouldn't just stop there. The next question really is, how are we going to respond to the authority of Jesus? How are we going to respond to one who clearly acts with the power and authority of God? The question is, are we going to submit or are we going to rebel? Now, as we jump into our text today, it becomes pretty clear in verse 1 what the chief priests, what the elders, what the teachers of the law and the whole Sanhedrin, what they're going to do, they are going to rebel. They've seized Jesus, okay, it's just after Gethsemane, and very early in the morning they've reached a decision, so they bound Jesus and they turn him over to Pilate. And Pilate, of course, he's the representative of Rome. His official title is the Procurator, or the Procurator of Judea. That's his official title. And he overrules on matters where the potential punishment is death. And that's an outcome that the Jewish authorities want to happen here. Now, up to this point in time, asking one of the Jewish authorities what they thought of Jesus, it's a bit like asking a lamppost what it thought about dogs. Okay, you would not get a good response. Let's be honest here, because Jesus, he'd upset the Jewish establishment right from the outset of his public ministry. He really had. I just backtrack a little bit. To begin with, he was an irregular. Although he posed as a rabbi, he had not entered through their correct door. Of course, you know, he'd not been to Moore College or anything like that. I'm just joking, by the way. Moore College wasn't around then, just so you know. Anyway, but he had no credentials, did he? He had no proper authorization in their eyes. His behavior hadn't endeared him to the Jewish authorities either. I mean, he hung out with a lot of, you know, feral types. That's what they'd say, isn't it? You know, he was baptized by, you know, let's be honest, he was a smelly insect-eating freak who wore camel hair. One of his disciples had a temper that made Mr. T look like a fairy. He fraternized with tax accountants. I mean, how bad can you get? I mean, that's terrible, isn't it? Prostitutes cavorted around his feet with their hair flowing and perfume everywhere. I mean, to them, that was just a bad look, wasn't it? He feasted when he should have been fasting. He healed people on the Sabbath, totally out of line, according to them. And then he had the audacity to effectively, you know, pistol whip the teachers of the law with their own teaching, making them look like fools in front of their mates. When he said, "You don't even know your own scriptures. You exalt tradition over the scriptures." He denounced them as hypocrites, you know, blind leaders of the blind. He likened them to whitewashed tombs. And the list just goes on. Actually, come to think of it, you know, the analogy of a lamppost and dogs is actually probably a bit light, isn't it, really, when you go through that? But I can't think of a better one for now. It kind of reminds me of the time I worked in an investment bank in London, and we used to have these teams that covered, you know, different areas of the world, and we worked in teams of five or six and all that kind of thing. And in one of the teams, and not mine, I'm just saying, not mine, but in one of the teams of five, they recruited this guy, and he was really good. He was a really gifted guy. And he could basically do the work of all those five guys and really showed them up for the layabouts that they really were. And so you know what they did? They fired the guy. It's a true story. They got rid of the guy because he made them look like idiots. And I think there's a bit of a similar thing going on here. But worse than all this was the fact that this Jesus was claiming to be the Lord of the Sabbath. He was claiming to know God uniquely as his Father, even to be equal to God. Now, you know, just to say those kind of things to a bunch of first century Palestine Jews invariably resulted in a date with a pile of rocks, didn't it? Because that was what they call blasphemy, claiming the authority of God. And the punishment for that kind of thing in Jewish circles, that was death. Now, of course, you know, a number of Fruit Loops down the ages have made similar claims, haven't they? Oh, another Messiah, you know, I don't know, smoked a little bit too much ganja, drank a little too much jungle juice or something, and suddenly they decide they're the Messiah. And look, to be honest, I think I've encountered a few of those myself. You may have too. The typical response is to ignore them, and eventually they fade into rehab and that kind of thing. But this is different, because this Messiah was not just talking as if he was God. I mean, any Fruit Loop can do that. He was acting as if he was God. And we've already touched on how that happened. And people were being won over to the authority that he claimed. This one is the real deal, they say. This one is that long-awaited Christ. This one is that Messiah for whom we've been waiting. And I'm reminded myself some time ago. I was watching on a BBC or something like that in the UK, and it had a documentary on this bunch of Orthodox Jews, and it followed them around and stuff like that. And they went, you know, all the curly locks and all that kind of thing. And they went on this prison visit, and they were singing to these prisoners, and it was all in Hebrew, so it had subtitles because I don't speak Hebrew. And the subtitles said the song they were singing was "The Messiah's Coming, The Messiah's Coming." And, you know, they've missed the boat, obviously, but this is pretty much what these guys would have been saying. They've been waiting for this guy. Yet as far as the Jewish establishment was concerned, this was all a threat to their authority. Too many of their people were being led astray for this just to be ignored. He wasn't just fading into rehab. Something had to be done to restore what they saw as the proper authority, which was them. Which is why they decided to send him to Pilate, because they wanted him dead. And, you know, you can just imagine for a moment how comical it must have seemed when Jesus appeared before Pilate, can't you? It's almost a direct fulfillment of Isaiah 53:2, which I'll read out. It says that he had no beauty of majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. So, you know, here before Pilate, just picture it, here before Pilate, you know, a man who moves in the circles of emperors and kings and all the Roman hoo-ha, a man familiar with pomp and ceremony, here before Pilate was one who claimed the ultimate authority of God's people. That's a mighty claim. Who appeared as, drumroll please, the rather disheveled son of a carpenter from Nazareth, who by now had an entourage of, let me count them on my fingers, zero, because they'd all deserted him, hadn't they? They'd all ditched him. Which is why Pilate says in verse 2, "Are you the king of the Jews?" You know, it's kind of, you're having a laugh, aren't you? You're taking the mickey. Has there been some sort of mix-up? Maybe ask the people in reception, "Is this the carpenter I was expecting, the king of the Jews? Where is he?" I suspect he's also having a dig at the Jewish people in general. Who I don't think he particularly likes anyways. He says, "Are you the king of the Jews? You know, hey guys, I'm loving your king right about now." You know. Now, in Roman circles, a decent defense to those kind of allegations would be expected. Particularly when your life is on the line, it would be expected. Some fine debate, some decent apologetics, or at least some groveling and crying and maybe they're paying over some money or something. That would be expected. But Jesus' response does none of that. And it flummoxes Pilate. It flummoxes him that in response to his question, "Are you the king of the Jews?" that he put to Jesus, Jesus responds with, you know, less words than a front row prop as he says, "Yes, it is as you say." Some other translations just have it as "so you say." That's three words. It's basically a non-answer. Verse 3 to 4 continues. The chief priest accused him of many things. So again, Pilate asked, "Aren't you going to answer? See how many things they are accusing you of." And as a side note, some of the other gospel accounts, particularly Luke, go into far more detail on the accusations. And there are many. There are lots of them. But the one the Jews had dropped in here to get Jesus in trouble with the Romans is the opposing of payment of taxes to Caesar and claiming to be king. Or to paraphrase, to refuse to submit to the authority of Caesar, instead submitting to the king of the Jews. And that, on the Roman side, though not really blasphemy, I don't think they really did that as such, that rebellion from Caesar was punishable by death. See, that was the instrument the Jews were using to get Jesus killed. And these are huge allegations. Yes, they are trumped up, but they are allegations that normally would require a response. So verse 5 tells us that Pilate was amazed that Jesus made no reply. And again, if we just backtrack 700 odd years earlier to Isaiah 53, we see that all this silence was foretold. Isaiah 53:7, "He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth." So he remained silent, like a sacrificial lamb, because that's what he was. You know, as he's already told us in Mark 10:45, he said, "The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many." So you see, Pilate was amazed, But Jesus was not amazed. Jesus was not surprised. Jesus expected this. This is what Jesus came to do. Jesus came to suffer, die, and rise. He's told his disciples that numerous times already in the Gospel of Mark. So no answer is required. In one sense, the answer to that question, are you the king of the Jews, is actually already provided in the prior 14 chapters of this gospel account, as we've seen Jesus speak and act with God's power and authority. We've seen that he is the king, and he's here in Jerusalem to die for his people. And also the answer to the question, are you the king of the Jews, is also provided in the whole canon of Scripture. He is this long-awaited Christ who brings about God's great plan to gather a people from fallen humanity by rescuing them from sin, by dying for them. He's here. He is the long-awaited king. And that's already been proved over and over again. And the more pertinent question for us here at this stage, as we get here in this gospel, is he your king? Is he your boss, or is he your lord? However you want to say that. Is he your king, or are you your king? At Christianity Explored, over the many years we've run it, I've had a number of people who've said to me, I'd submit to Jesus as my Lord, if only he'd appear to me and do something extra. And if that's you, well, I tell you now, you'll get the same response that Pilate gets here. It's silence. Because God has already spoken. God has already acted, ultimately in the person and work of Jesus Christ by the power of the Spirit. And it's all set out for you here in this gospel account. And the question is, how have you responded? How have you responded to that authority? Have you submitted or have you rebelled? And to the regulars here at St. John's, and of course I'm speaking to myself here as I say this, to those of you who occasionally might find yourself drifting off when you think the preacher is just preaching to newcomers, and hands high, I have done that on occasion. The question to us is, how do we continually respond to the authority of Jesus? Because he's not just king for a day, the day of your salvation. How do we respond day after day in obedience to his authority? Do we respond? It's worth thinking about for each one of us what that looks like for us here today. It really is. So moving along, in verse 6, we're introduced to the person of Barabbas. Now Barabbas, his name in Hebrew means son of the father. You can just smell the irony happening here, can't you? Son of the father. He's a man in prison for murder. He's a man who was in jail with the insurrectionists, as the NIV calls it. It's a flash word. That is to say, he had been involved with some rebellion against the nation, which is also a familiar charge, isn't it? Again, you can smell the irony here. According to our text, there is a custom that a guilty man goes free during the Feast of Passover. So the crowd comes to Pilate and they ask that this custom may continue. Now, verses 9 and 10 is very insightful here, because Pilate then asks them if they would like to have Jesus released. Knowing that it was out of envy that the chief priests had handed Jesus over to him. It was out of envy. Now, there's no doubt Pilate's assessment, there's no reason to doubt Pilate's assessment here. He seems to be a pretty shrewd judge of character, and the gospel accounts as a whole do endorse his judgment here. So at the heart of the Jews, handing Jesus over to Pilate was not blasphemy. That was merely the tool by which they did it. It was actually envy that was the driver. Envy was the driver here. And as John Stott in The Cross of Christ, a good book, by the way, if you do, you should read it at least once in your life, he said that envy is the reverse side of a coin called vanity. Envy is the reverse side of a coin called vanity. That is to say, nobody is ever envious of others who is not first proud of himself. So envy and pride are two sides of the same coin. And the Jewish leaders, they were proud. They were proud of their nation's long history. They were proud of their special relationship with God. They were proud of their leadership roles, and above all, they were proud of their authority. So you see, their contest with Jesus was essentially an authority struggle. He challenged their pride by challenging their authority. while at the same time possessing himself power and authority which they just didn't have. So however respectable the priest's arguments may have appeared before Pilate, it was actually envy which led them to hand Jesus over to Pilate to be destroyed. But before we round out on the Jews here, and many shamefully have used this passage to do that down the ages, they have. Before we round out on the Jews, isn't that the same prideful attitude at the heart of our own battle with the authority of Jesus? And I put it to you, it is. You know, we resent his intrusions into our private lives. You know, to say we're sinners in need of rescue. We resent his demand for allegiance in our own lives. You know, to take up our cross and follow him. We resent that. We resent his expectation of our obedience. You know, why can't he just mind his own business and leave us alone? To which I'd imagine he would say, well, you are my business. And I will never leave you alone because I love you too much. So truth be told, it's not just the Jews who want to get rid of Jesus. We all want to get rid of Jesus. Because you see, in this picture here, we're all in the crowd, all of us. We're all in it. You, me, we're all in there, which is why verse 11 is so fitting here. Verse 11, but the chief priest stirred up the crowd to have Pilate release Barabbas instead of Jesus. So we're all in that crowd. We all stand condemned as we condemn Jesus to the cross. But you might be sitting there thinking, well, look, I might not be for Jesus, but I'm not really, I wouldn't say I'm against him. You know, maybe I'm a little bit like Pilate in this story, just kind of sitting there objectively over this and kind of looking down and I can speak impartially to this whole thing. Well, come with me and look at verse 12 onwards, where Pilate then asks the crowd, what shall I do then with the one you call the King of the Jews? Crucify him, they shouted. Verse 14, Pilate says, why, what crime has he committed? No answer. Crucify him, they shouted all the louder. And significantly, here's what the narrator tells us about Pilate. And note, this is Tim Training 101. Whenever you hear the narrator make a statement, there's no debate here. So verse 15, wanting to satisfy the crowd. That's the narrator speaking. Wanting to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas to them. So Pilate knew Jesus was innocent, but he wanted to please the crowd more than he wanted to act with a clear conscience. And people-pleasing does that to people, doesn't it? It pressures people to act against their convictions. There is always great pressure to conform. There is always great pressure to people-please, to act against your convictions. And none more so, I put it to you, none more so than when it comes to following Jesus. New Zealand is renowned worldwide as being one of the most secularized Western nations. People-pleasing is big here. And look, you know, in New Zealand, you're not going to get rocks in the head for following Jesus, and that's a good thing, but you will be shut off. You will be quietly marginalized by workmates and family. It'll be very subtle. It'll be very polite, but it will happen. And the temptation for you will be to people-please. The pressure will be on to you not to submit to the authority of Jesus in your life. You know, what do my friend and family think? What do my friends and family think? You know, they'll think I've gone a bit serious on this Christian stuff. I kind of want to please them. I kind of want to get affirmation from them. Maybe I'll just tone this whole thing down. Maybe I'll just ditch it. And even as you continue to follow Jesus, the pressure will remain. It doesn't go away. It really doesn't. And that's why we need to keep up meeting together like this, so we can encourage one another to resist that temptation to run the race and all those kind of analogies. So Pilate might have seen himself as the enlightened one here. And, you know, as Steve mentioned at the introduction, some in church circles, they're actually still quite partial to Pilate. But at the end of the day, even Pilate is not exonerated in the gospel accounts. Because though he had his convictions, he did not act on them. And I challenge each one of us here today, as you feel the convictions of the gospel here, and you feel the authority of the Lord Jesus, and on the other hand, you feel that kind of temptation to people please, I ask you, choose this day which one you will serve, because you cannot serve both. You can only serve one. So apart from Jesus, no one is exonerated in this passage. As Dick Lucas said of this passage, he said, it shows man at his worst and Jesus at his glorious best. And I think that's absolutely true in this passage. There's no question here who the true king is, and there's no question who we are. As Horatius Bonar, he wrote a number of famous hymns. He wrote this one in 1856 on this particular passage. I'm normally not into reading it, hymns and poems and things and sermons, but I remember listening to this when I was a fairly young Christian. I thought I'd read it out to you because it struck me and I still remember it. And it's on this passage. Horatius said this. He's saying this. I see the crowd in Pilate's hall, their furious cries I hear, their shouts of crucify appall, their curses fill mine ear. And of that shouting multitude I feel that I am one, and in the din of voices rude I recognize my own. And I ask you today, do you recognize your voice in there, in that crowd? Because we're all there. Do you recognize it? And if you do, I want to say, I was thinking about this as I was preparing this. I mean, it feels horrid. It feels horrid hearing your voice in that crowd, realizing that was me. I was in there. But on the flip side of that, that's a good thing. That's a positive thing, because only when you see your guilt before God, only then will you see your need to partake in this transaction that is going on in front of the crowd. And it's a transaction which foreshadows what will take place at the cross. A transaction by which the guilty, like Barabbas and like us, go free as the innocent, that is Jesus, pay the price for our rejection of the authority of God. And that's a price that will ultimately take him to the cross, which is at the center of why he came. And we're going to be unpacking a bit more about that next week as I speak on the cross. But you must recognize your part in all of this before you are to progress any further in this. You must. Verse 15. Pilate, he had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. That's a short line, isn't it? It's a horrid line, though, as well. Because you can actually insert your own name there. You know, we all had him flogged. We all had him handed over to be crucified. But it says so much, doesn't it? The decision has been made. The next phase has been entered. There's no going back. And from here on, the crucifixion really begins. And I say that because Roman crucifixion involved more than just simply putting a guy on a cross to die. It involved the complete degradation of a person and unrestrained torture so as to make punishment the ultimate deterrent to anyone who refused to submit to the authorities. And Mark's purpose here as he does this is not to graphically display the torture that Jesus endured, because we actually see virtually nothing of Jesus' response to what happens here. Ironically, the emphasis continues to be on the authority of Jesus. It's almost deep fried in irony, this whole text we're in today. Massive irony in here. Verse 16 to 20 then gives us a wee postscript of how we should be responding to this authority of this Jesus who actually is a king and will bring about his kingdom through a cross, and in doing so reconciling rebellious people to himself. Verse 16 to 20 gives us a hint of how we should be responding to this king who deserves homage, that is worship. Because as you look through verses 16 to 20, again, as I said, dripping in irony, Jesus is acknowledged as the king. Ironically, it's the king of the Jews. Jesus is given homage, ironically, by being dressed in purple, crowned with thorns. Jesus is given obedience, ironically, by having them fall on their knees before him and address him as they would address Caesar himself, as they say, "Hail, King of the Jews." And in principle, that submission, the homage, the obedience, those are all things that we all ought to be doing in response to this king and the message he has brought to the world in this gospel account. That is, if we want to partake in this glorious transaction where the guilty go free as the innocent takes our punishment. We're all called to acknowledge him as our king. We're all called to give him homage. We're called ultimately to give him our obedience. And the question the Gospel of Mark is pushing us to consider right here is, have we done that? And do we continue to do that day upon day? So wherever you are, new or old, Jesus invites your continued obedience to the King of Kings.